Hi, this is 180 Degrees, a show about the changes we all need to make for a clean energy future. Brought to you by SEAI. Episode 6, How You Can Make a Difference.
Hello everyone, and a big welcome to my guests. Kevin O'Sullivan, Environment and Science Editor at the Irish Times. Actress and climate change activist, Evan McCann. Community Programme Executive Gillian Gannon and Karen Finnegan, Cool Planet Champion and Chairperson of the Killinaran Ballyfad Sustainable Energy Community in Wexford. Hello and a big welcome to you all.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Hey. Thank you.
Thanks. Broad grins all round. We'll wipe them off shortly. So I'm going to start with you, Karen. Yeah. The accent will give it away pretty quickly that you are from the US of A, but you're now living in Wexford. Tell us about the move across and how that came about.
My husband and I moved over the very first time in the year 2000. And we were up here in the heart of Dublin and we lived and enjoyed life and ended up going back. He wanted to try a business over there. When that was completed, it was time to come over again. And this time had no idea where we'd land. It happened that we were very, very fortunate to find North Wexford through no fault or knowledge of our own. And it also coincided with my stopping formal work. So I would be an A-type personality who normally knows exactly what's coming next. I made a very conscious effort not to know what was coming next and to let something come to me. And what came to me was all of this that's going on around the climate and things that need to be done or could be done. In my heart of hearts, I've always had that as a core element of myself, but you wouldn't know it to look at my carbon footprint. I traveled globally on a weekly basis. I will never overcome my carbon footprint, no matter what I do. But here I am living in the heart of farmland, rural Ireland, with a community that has people who commute up here, people who've lived there their whole lives. And it just started to become real to me that beyond tidy towns and taking action in the community, we could do something more. And the more, things just started coming out of the ether. And I'd look and read and, you know, it's a compilation of the things I've done in my life that allow me to be doing what I'm doing now. And it just happens to be a great group of people to work with as well.
And can we just get a particular perspective before we move to some of the other guests that, you know, we here in the protected old Western Europe look across the pond and we see President Trump having withdrawn from Paris Agreement and he's a great pariah and all of that. But does that reflect what you see amongst individuals in the US? Is everyone turned off climate action or is it just at a federal government level?
I think it's something in between those two. My last neighbor in the U.S. had an electric car, had paid for everything in a way that would be as carbon neutral as possible. I looked over the fence and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder, should I be doing that? I didn't, but, you know, it hit me. So you look at the country as a whole and all the different places there are. California, which is bigger than Ireland and however many little countries over here, they're still, as a single entity, doing more toward climate change and sticking with Paris than what the president is saying he's not going to do. Okay. So I think it isn't just one or the other. It's somewhere in the middle.
Great. And we might come back to that sure. Perspective of individual versus collective action. So, Evan, you're a theatre, film and television actor, mm-hmm. and you've had roles in Vikings and Can't Cope, Won't Cope. Mm-hmm. But you're also very interested and you're a strong advocate of all matters environmental. So how did that come about?
Well, I think it's because I grew up in the countryside and as a country child in the Cooley Mountains, I never took for granted how lucky we were to have that on our doorstep. And I don't know why that was, probably because my mother's a townie from Newry and there was her experience of having these green lands and quite untouched for the most part. I also can't discount the fact that my great aunt, we called her Granny Mary, her granddaughter is my best friend. So it was a very small community and like happened to be related to quite a lot of the people in the Glen. And I vividly remember being University of Maynooth and going on behalf of the youth contingent to prevent mining on that area or testing for mining. And this woman who was about four foot 11 found herself in front of a gate stopping a machine. And actually talking about it now, it's quite emotional because you realise that that feeling of needing to protect something is innate in people. And one of the arguments I make more recently is that if the closer we get to the land, the more likely we are to want to look after it and protect it. And we have kind of separated ourselves from that. In the meantime, I became an actor, having done a degree in sociology and French. And then anytime I do press, it's come up. I happened to do a photo shoot last year on slow fashion. And that's an idea where you don't buy anything that's from the high street or brand new. You've really thought out what you want to buy. And I always say it's a gateway drug into environmentalism because people want to talk to me about nice clothes and then I end up talking about biodiversity. So that I became a member of the Dublin Ecofeminists as well, which is a group of people who all happen to be women at the moment who support each other, who have their own journey in climate activism. And that sort of helps give energy to different people's hopes and dreams. And in the meantime, I tend to shoehorn, if one for a better word, climate activism into every interview I do. So that's how it happened. And because I'm an actor, I'm a little less afraid of speaking about it, I guess. And I found myself emceeing panels and being not dragged, actually happily taken into it. I just want to do something. I think it comes from needing to want to make a change, and as an individual, wanting to feel like there's something being done. It's probably a mental health thing more than anything, because I don't know if you can get up in the morning knowing what we know about the world and not doing something about it.
Kevin, you've had a long career in journalism and you've seen a lot along the way, but you right now as the environment and science editor. And do you think has it become easier or harder to get coverage and to feature environmental issues, or what are the particular challenges that you're encountering?
Well, in the modern news era, it's increasingly chaotic. You have 24-hour repeated deadlines, so it's become ferociously competitive in terms of competing news items. But I think in the last 18 months, it's very interesting in Ireland, there has been a shift and, very detailed, extensive coverage of climate factors has come into the agenda. But there still is an outstanding issue in the sense that people perceive it's going to happen in decades' time and, we'd be all right now. And you kind of have to fight against that. But I think there's a significant groundswell of public concern out there now, and they want really meaningful action. And it goes through every strand of society already from people here today. You've got indication of that. And I think people, particularly young people, are less tolerant of politicians saying, oh, look, we're looking at it, we'll try and resolve matters. That's just not good enough anymore. And just look at the last month in terms of record temperatures in parts of the world, heat waves that we know were worsened because of climate change, melting ice. Alaska has no ice within 150 metres of the coastline anymore. The Greenland ice sheet is melting at a far greater pace than anyone could have predicted. There are signs everywhere you look, and even the latest verdict of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is really shocking and very worrying. And, you don't want to cause alarm everywhere you go, but look, it's staring us in the face.
So, Gillian, you work with myself in SEAI and our good colleagues in SEAI, and you're with the Sustainable Energy Communities. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that programme is and the network?
Yeah, it's a programme that is basically designed to support communities in achieving their sustainable energy goals, and that can be in various different ways. There's over 300 communities now in the network, including Karen's community here.
Kyle and Aaron, just so we say it.
Oh, Kyle and Aaron. Kyle and Aaron Ballyfad, that's right. And basically, these 300 communities, more than 300 communities, are doing something. Some of them are doing a lot, some of them are just doing a little, but they're all doing something in terms of climate action and sustainable energy. A lot of the communities that come to us, a lot of them are already established tidy towns committees or environmental groups, or it could be a group of people that just come together and go, do you know what, this thing is becoming too hard to ignore, let's do something about it. And the interesting thing is we get an awful lot of people coming to us and they're looking at the legacy that they're going to leave in their community and looking at the future generations, and it might be they're looking at the face of their own children or their grandchildren, and they're going, we can't just sit here and do nothing anymore. And they want to become very active. And the sustainable energy thing has obviously been around for a long time. And even the last few years, the motivation for joining the network has changed. Beforehand, it could be about saving money, could be about making buildings more comfortable and healthier. That's all great. Now the main motivation is climate action. And off the back of that, we're not only seeing more groups join the network, but they want to do a huge amount, and they have that ambition and that energy. Like you talked about energy earlier, it is this energy and something that Karen has in spades. And it's a really good thing to see. And bringing it back to the question of can individuals make a difference? I suppose I'm in a very, very, very lucky and privileged position that I get to see that every day. And I don't doubt that for a moment.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And I got my first rebuke there for the mispronunciation of the community in North Wexford.
Listen, I'm an American. I had to learn how to say it.
This podcast is about what we can do as individuals. So we sent Ellen out onto the streets of Dublin to ask people what they think. Let's have a listen.
One big problem is carbon emissions. So to reduce carbon emissions, I'd recommend driving less where you could walk. Like I know people that, you know, live at a shop that's like 2 minutes away. If you could walk.
I think people should use reusable nappies instead of disposable ones to help landfill.
I think that unfortunately what an individual can do is rather limited, even though of course you can try and separate your waste and all that kind of stuff. And of course I'm for doing something on an individual level, but I think industry and other third world countries, they have such a great amount of pollution that whatever we try to do, and I think we're already trying to do much, will be rather limited in effect.
Okay, so I think that the supermarkets should scrap all packaging on fresh fruit and vegetables. We don't need it. They can go straight in the shopping basket that you have with you.
Don't use plastic straws, but also don't use plastic cups.
So there's a lot of different perspectives there that relate to waste, packaging, energy, and what the rest of the world is doing. But can we just start with the current fashionable item to put down, which is the reusable coffee cup, or to pick up is the reusable coffee cup, as distinct from the single-use coffee cup. But people tend to have a perspective, well, now that's me done. I've done that. Who wants to dive in and pick up? What's the challenge there, or why is that?
Yeah, well, a lot of people on the streets did talk about plastics and reusables and all that sort of stuff, which is fine, and it's so worth doing. And we can see now, I think it's nearly David Attenborough's Blue Planet 2 that kind of really got that going, amongst plenty of other things. And we're all talking about microplastics. The only thing is about that is that what can that do for climate change? If we're talking, it's an environmental issue, and it's a really important environmental issue. But if you took all the plastics out of the ocean, we'd still have, the planet is still warming. So does that mean to me that people are focusing on this because it's more tangible and easier to understand, or maybe easier to act on, rather than stuff like food and transport and energy, which are the three biggest, you know, emitters of carbon and other greenhouse gases?
I would say as well that one of the things that probably started me was that into this whole, I guess, not adventure, it's a nice word to put on it, is that I had a reusable cup, and I do have a reusable cup and a reusable bottle, and I had that alongside me for a year before I really acknowledged the extent of the issue. I was doing my bit, so to speak, and I get texts constantly, you'll be so proud of me, I have this, or, and now it's become so normal that people know that it's not okay. And one of the worries, one of the pros I think of that is that if we could speed up the realization of what we can do as individuals. I'm going to tangent here. I have to say also that making it about the individual, I find that problematic. It's such a massive issue, and I understand that we do it for ourselves in order to feel like we've empowered, as you were saying, Gillian. It's tangible to feel like you might be doing something yourself, but obviously they're all connected. And for me, plastic is it feels ugly, even though I'm using reusable plastic right now. It feels ugly, it feels wrong, it feels like it's not supposed to be near us. That's what it started to feel like recently. And I think that in tandem with the issues we have with biodiversity, that all sort of becomes one. I'm always thinking about oh, where's that plastic going to go? And
where did the plastic come from? Where did it come from? Plastic is a fossil fuel.
It's a fossil fuel, yeah. So it's, I guess I completely agree with Gillian in that, yeah, like it's a small thing, but it does drive a bigger sentiment. And that is...
It's almost like a gateway drug in a sense. That's what I'm
saying,
yeah.
Second gateway drug of the podcast.
Slow fashion and reusable plastic.
Yeah.
And it is, find it excruciatingly difficult to shop for food these days in the city centre of Dublin without feeling like you just can't buy a sandwich without it being in plastic. Mm. Especially, when I was on tour last year, being in certain parts of the country, beautiful parts of the country, and finding it literally impossible to get a takeaway sandwich. Again, that's me being a human being who's been used to convenience, and that in itself has been a massive issue. Yeah. And clearly, like, that's
a little example, I take a plastic container that I've had for a long time into the Superquin.
Yeah.
And I say to them, cut the meat,
yeah,
you know, the sandwich, and put it in that.
Yeah, my mum has started doing that.
That's
yeah.
a good ploy.
Yeah,
it is. Well, it's a fine ploy, yeah, but yeah. the woman behind the counter, the first one got it. Nice, no problem. The second one put it in the plastic bag and then was going to put that in my container. And I thought, oh, no.
Yeah, there's definitely,
you know, so there's a big awareness and learning campaign that in my mind says every individual needs to be touched enough so that the worker behind the counter has a clue as to why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
She doesn't have to do it herself. I don't mind. But if every person has something that makes them aware, and it could be the coffee cups, the entree to the awareness.
Yeah. The entree,
but it's
yeah.
easier to have yeah. something come next if you've already got the base started.
Yeah, so it's almost like that woman is just, she's on autopilot. She's so used.
Oh, she is, for sure.
Yeah.
In a big sense, we're all on autopilot, and autopilot has nearly gotten to us where we are now. But if it is the plastic thing that disrupts that autopilot
yeah.
position that we're in and maybe starts making us second guess our actions a little bit, like maybe Karen, you might have said to her, I don't need that extra plastic there, I have this, maybe that gets her second guessing her actions going forward. Well, hopefully. And that's the individual influence that someone can have on someone else, that maybe they can talk to someone else or influence someone else.
But Kevin, the talk there is of this tangible thing of the plastics, and it's in front of us, and we can see the microbeads on Blue Planet, and you know, we can see landfill. Is it easier to write about plastics as well than it is energy?
It is, in the sense that people identify with it, and that's another great change in sort of public understanding. But as a scientist, I'm slightly wary of some of it, because I think plastic does have a role. Like, you know, plastic, if you look at 3D manufacturing, plastic is phenomenal what it can do in terms of food safety. And particularly in the developing world, plastic, you know, in terms of hard plastic, can really fulfill a role. But it's what you do with it. And fortunately, the EU is making a big move in terms of the circular economy. So, you know, in almost every scenario now, plastic, in whatever form it is, will have to be reusable. And it's end use as well. So all of that has come onto the agenda. And, you know, it's all very well saying, oh, I'm reducing my plastic. But you know, you have to sort of think it through in terms of, you know, your lifestyle, what you do with it at the end, the plastic that you use in terms of the permanent plastic bottle that you reuse all the time. Ultimately, what's going to happen to that? Fortunately, as well, the technology in terms of plastic recycling is improving dramatically. Though in Ireland, we have poor infrastructure in terms of recycling PET bottles, for example. But that is changing. And, you know, I take your point about, you know, plastic comes from fossil fuel initially. So, you know, so we have to really think all that through. And I think we are moving in the right direction.
There's another point that came up on the Vox Pop, where people say, leave it to big business, because big business are the problem. Or let's not bother doing anything because other countries are the problem and we're little old Ireland and we can do nothing. So big business are the problem.
Yeah, well, I would say big business is a major part of the problem, and possibly the major part. And then you must include fossil fuel industry in that category. And the scale of emissions that they generate is immense in comparison to the individual. And so that you know, you have to balance up that. But the scale of the whole climate problem is such that, you know, everyone has to participate. Everyone has to change their lifestyle, whether it's diet, whether it's plastic, whether it's consumption practices in terms of the family home, whether it's energy consumption, because it's not going to happen without that collective buy-in. And that goes across the developing world in particular. I having just come back from Africa, I think, you know, I see the consequences there for people that haven't a huge carbon footprint, but they're in the direct firing line. So, you have to make some account for that and support them as best you can. But, you know, the extent of the emergency that's facing us all is such that, you know, if one element bows out, if one sector says it's not my fault, I'm not going to be able to do anything, then you have a situation where globally, you know, the response is not going to be sufficient.
But just to challenge you on that, Kevin, for a moment, if we point at industry in that way, it makes it look like it's some entity off in the corner using energy and burning fossil fuels for the good of its health.
Yeah.
They are providing products and services
to us.
They are,
so, yeah.
And the homes we live in use a quarter of our fossil fuels.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the private transport is a fifth.
Yeah.
So do we have a little, should we put our hands up a little bit on it as individuals?
No, I'm saying the individual has to respond and change in a very dramatic way. Mm-hmm. But it's hard, and, you know.
Yeah, how do we do that?
Yeah,
that's a genuine question.
I think it's hard to be sustainable in this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I encounter people, you know, that are just overwhelmed by the issue and almost don't want to talk about it. Then people are sort of overcome by guilt, and then others don't know what to do. And I use the start out point of Mary Robbins. She says, okay, get angry and protest, but do something. And I think that's where it has to happen. And it might be only a small thing, but I think it's building on, like, your community group shows that you start with one thing and you build on that. And I think that's where you get momentum. And that is going to be an amazing force for change. And that, in my view, is going to force corporations to become really carbon conscious and to do it with transparency and be meaningful in what they do. And we have a long way to go. Mm. But I think that's going to be the real big sort of change in the corporate world.
So Karen, can I just bring you in there? So there's kind of three bits to that. There's and you should be able to reflect on this, I think, from your community group. There's what the individual can do. There's what the individuals can do together. And then what all of those individuals can do to influence the outside world as such, the suppliers into their small economy. So where did your community group start?
Piece. Yeah. The individual, when an individual becomes aware, whether it's this issue or another, they're going to then, through that lens, see the life they lead, the products they buy, the ways they go about their daily living. I'll move right to the big companies, which have in their marketing departments sold us on the idea that we can't live without plastic bottles of water. 20 years ago, nobody knew from a plastic bottle of water. That didn't happen because of something changing in our lives. That happened to us through marketing from big companies. Can we move back? Sure we can. But we're not going to move back by buying the water anyway, or saying, well, that water's got to be better. We have to take the action, and it's individuals who stand in the market and buy those bottles of water. Mm-hmm. Now, I live in a place where we have fabulous water. I had a fellow working for me, though. He lives in Gori. They can't drink their water. I had no idea that when I'm being judgmental in the market line, saying, why are they buying six packs of large bottles of water? They don't need it. Well, maybe they do because the water that comes out of their tap is not potable. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to it. But first point, the individual is the place that you start by putting up your hand and saying, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. Mm. It won't happen soon enough that will make the change for the businesses. But if it doesn't start there, why in God's name would you as a CEO change what you're doing if the product is selling and you're making more profit year on year?
This is the moral thing I go.
You wouldn't.
But I totally, and that's unfortunately how we are. My dad would always say, human beings are just, we are like that. We will say, I can't change it, it's working for me. It's the same reason Gillian and I were chatting about the politicians. It's like, you go, oh yeah, but how does somebody, the head of Monsanto, wake up in the morning and like look at themselves? But they do, and they get on with it. And
they do, because they also have this little group that are doing nice things toward the environment.
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm doing that.
Yeah.
That's, they are beholden to their shareholders. We've moved into a time where quarterly profits are what drive business. Short-term thinking in politicians, it's no different. Short-term thinking in businesses, it's all happened over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, so I think Mary Robinson did say, I attended two talks that she was part of, and she did point out that business was probably one of the more impactful ways of changing how we live, and that actually the machine, the thought machine, the thinking machine behind that, sustainable thinking machine behind a lot of business, is might be what where the hope is actually. So I'm hoping that Mary Robinson isn't just giving false hope.
That's a really good point, and I would add that we're at a very interesting point in history whereby it's one of these rare occasions, and Bill McKibben, the great US environmentalist, has talked about it, where individual collective action is forcing the hand of big business. And that is, you know, a source of great hope, given, you know, that there's so much gloom about climate change. And it does show that that when these forces combine across borders, across generations, that they can force the hand. And even fossil fuel companies now have been forced to be more accountable and to really identify what their full carbon footprint is as a consequence of that. So, you know, maybe we're going to go to a better place, even though there are other factors that suggest they're still at their old bad habits.
Yeah, it's the fashion industry is an interesting place to look at what's happening there. As somebody who in Ireland is an advocate for slow fashion, so I haven't bought a new thing from the high street in 2 years. I don't go up the high street. I find it quite difficult now to be on it. Not to sound too dramatic, but it just feels like I'm bombarded with all the messages, which I clearly have avoided, which is quite, it's an example in itself that we are told constantly we need new things. And we know that the pollution as a result of fast fashion, which is, if anyone's wondering, ultimately what you buy on the high street, is something that for the most part gets worn 3 times. That's what the pattern has been in the last few years with fashion. And like Karen was saying, we manage without bottled water before it arrived, and we managed without fast fashion, and we were still able to be stylish. It's about changing the mindset of what it means to be stylish. And my big push this year has been, I'm on charity shops, and you know, because they're bombarded with stuff we don't want anymore, and then they're losing, where does that go?
Probably stuff
and
that isn't even that old as well.
No, absolutely. And that's the joy and the sadness of a charity shop. You can find new things and wonder why they end up there. But actually it is quite an exciting, fun, active, tangible thing that is forcing the fashion industry to rethink how they function. And they still have the £1 bikini from Boohoo that went viral, this whole horrendous thing of who made that, how much did it cost to make it, you know, how much did it cost the planet to make it. So the fashion industry is a funny one, is an interesting one to watch too, to see what's going to happen. I think the forecast is that 90% of consumers will buy secondhand in the next 10 years. But 10 years is...
Is that too late? There's an interesting app called Good On You that one of the girls in work showed me, and it you put in the name of the shop that you're going into, so it could be any of the high street shops, and it gives a rating. And you get to see on, you know, an environmental scale, the rate on environmental criteria. I think it's... maybe human resourcing, or, you know, ethical labour kind of resourcing, and then animal testing. And it is something that ever since I heard of that, I do put in, you know, whichever shop I'm inclined to go into and get something. And I'm like, oh, that's not
I know it's quite hardline, but I just don't go into them because I feel like that some of them do. There are people clearly who work in that industry who want to make a change and they're up against the CEO who wants to keep doing what they're doing because people are buying it. Yeah. And so until there's a massive shift in how things are sold, I think sadly it's going to have to just it's going to have to be deconstructed entirely for it to make any sense environmentally.
You know, there's manufacturing, which deals with all the issues that you're talking about. Manufacturing of clothing, you won't be buying all new things if the manufacturer shifts you won't be able to. The cost of doing cheap labor, cheap product components, that'll be gone. And then you have to look at, okay, who is it that's buying and why are they buying? The main buying public, is it 18 to 35-year-olds? Are they not being driven the same way with marketing that the water bottles were? You've got to have new, because why would you wear something twice?
Yeah, and why would you be seen wearing something twice?
Exactly.
Yeah,
but there is a whole tranche of the public for whom that is not the way they live, which is why coming back to the individual and listening to how someone lives their life and looking at what are the things that they can do. It's different across country, city, age groups, etc. So,
but I just reckon we've got our third spin-off series now that we'll do one totally on slow versus fast fashion. But Karen, I wanted to bring you back in because we sort of leapfrogged. We went from the individual out to big business and the role it has to play, and how collectively, if we force their hand, that they will start to produce something more sustainable. Can we come back into the middle, which is and focusing on
group,
the community?
Right.
How does a group work together? And can I just ask you to say specifically within the energy sphere, because that's something that people feel is either individual or outside their control. So how does a community take control of its energy?
We in Kylinearan, I came to them once I heard about the SEC, and I said, you know, there is no downside to us becoming a sustainable energy community. All I can see is potential upside, and why wouldn't we do it? So of course the answer was yes. We went forward, and I have a committee of people ranging from dairy farmers to the local priests to people who commute up to UCD, a wide range of people who have some knowledge and more interest in helping the community, the country, the globe in this area of energy. And what we've done for the first year is following the path that's been set out by the SEAI. But what we say as we're talking to the community, we've just come through doing energy surveys. So we have 1,200 households. We were hoping to get something like 40% of them to fill out an energy survey. We came close. We got about 35%, which is phenomenal in that space. And the issue for each household was, why would I bother doing this? What's in it for me? We are suggesting to them that there are many small changes, but hopefully there will be an opportunity for you to make a change that's going to save you money as well as be good for the environment. Mm. So we're trying to be totally pragmatic. You've got an oil tank out there. How many times a year do you fill it? Do you understand that oil, the burn rate of oil, is such that you're losing half of it up to the sky anyway? You're doing damage, but you're also not getting good value for your money. Mm. So these are conversations that on a doorstep, over a cup of coffee, we sent some teenagers out to do the surveying with people. That's where you can get somebody to maybe catch on. They're not catching on to fair trade. They're not catching on to, I want to beat my chest and be part of the climate revolution. But this is going to save me money and actually make my life a warmer house, a safer house, maybe not so much asthma. There are so many ways to attack the energy element of it. So that's what we're trying to do, put together groups of houses, find things that can be done that will improve that householder's life. Mm-hmm. And if we can touch all of our community and find one thing that they can do that's going to make their life better, why wouldn't we do that in the way that's actually going to move forward and hopefully have at least a few of them get serious about climate change?
Yeah.
So that big dream, another thing that Mary Robinson, Queen Mary Robinson, should say, has said was, we have to just keep dreaming big, dreaming exciting things about how we could live with what we have and without what we ultimately don't need or what's doing damage to us and the earth. So it's kind of exciting when you let yourself go there. It's a very positive feeling. It's very energizing. So it's exciting to hear about communities like that.
And Karen, you also organized a sustainability fair in February.
Oh, we did that indeed.
And if you want to hear about the power of an individual, listen to this because it's amazing.
Well, the idea was, rather than sticking to just the energy element of the sustainable energy community, let's go as broad as possible on sustainability. God knows how many people would want to come, who would come along to talk. All of that was 6 months before, had no idea what we'd do. But what we ultimately had was 30 people who took a stall to talk about some element of sustainability. And we had 12 speakers, ranging from Connor Murphy, who is a big speaker. Oh, he happens to be from Kylinearan, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So he came, you know, and very quietly a farmer whispered to me, yeah, we'll get Connor to come along. He's a pretty good kid. It'll be all right. So, you know, this is how you build it. You build it by doing that. And we had 500 people walk through the door.
That's phenomenal. I think we have to look at the next stage, though, because I think you need mass engagement. And like, if you just look at the targets for electric vehicles for the next 10 years, almost a million EVs, the number of 500,000 houses that have to switch to heat pump, whatever, you know, all those are huge, huge figures. And if that willingness is not harnessed in terms of engagement with a very flexible, practical process whereby, you know, I can convert my house going to a one-stop shop, I think you're not going to get the scale of climate action that we urgently need. And that, you know, I know that touches on the work of the SEAI in a huge way, but I don't see that coming, to be honest with you, notwithstanding the great success of community groups and SECs as well. You know, that jump, I don't see it coming in the next 2 years. And I don't hate to be sort of pessimistic, but I think there's a likely scenario where our emissions are going to continue to rise, as you know, because we've got population growth, we've got increased wealth, unless there's a terrible collapse after Brexit. But, you know, I think that's where the next big collective action needs to be, so that we can all avail of the real tangible benefits that you've outlined in terms of community action.
Yeah, and it is known, those tangible benefits, they're there. At any kind of community or public events that we go to, the most common question that we get asked is, what can I do, or what can I do next? So some might be like, well, I've insulated my home, but I'm not really sure where to go next. And people seem to want this pathway, and they'll do it, even if it costs money, even if it's inconvenient. They will do it, but they're just unclear of what they want to do, or maybe unaware of what they can do. And you do need to look at, there is an awful lot of power that an individual has, both in everyday ways and in the big life decisions. From what you pick to eat, what you choose to eat, from when you wake up in the morning, turn on lights, what transport you choose to do, all those little decisions factor into something bigger. And then you do have your bigger life decisions then as well to think about, like when you're buying a house or a car, or deciding whether or not to have children, or how many children to have, or even when to retire. Any of those sort of things do have a carbon emission or a carbon footprint, all our decisions. It's just understanding those decisions, and it can be quite complicated. People do need to be educated on both the impact of their small decisions and their big decisions, and know that every choice does matter, that every person makes, and be empowered to believe, to acknowledge that, and to know that their decisions actually do have an impact. Was at a climate change conference that was organised by the EPA there a few months ago, and I forget his name, but there was a really good speaker that was up, and he did say, you know, every year matters, every degree matters, and every choice matters. And I remembered that particular, the choice one in particular. And then I went home and I was like, not having meat for dinner. No, I'm going to try and you know, eat whatever I can that isn't meat, basically. But
I'm totally on board with all of that. I always, and as somebody who has made changes in my life, I feel like I'm doing it, if I'm honest, so that I can feel like I'm not part of a problem. And what I would love to see, and I'm not entirely sure how it's to happen, how we can create an community or a society where people can actually engage without it feeling like it's a different planet. Because so many individuals would like to be able to do that, I think. I think that people would like to be able to use good public transport that gets them from A to B, that their life, obviously, that would obviously take some reconfiguring, because sometimes the job choice or their career, you know, how we set up communities, how we set up towns, how we plan towns and cities needs to be considered. And again, that comes back to the 5-year plan of a government isn't, you know, we can't make big changes if they've done something like put a Lewis track in, and now they can't go under the Lewis track because that costs so much money and all this kind of stuff. So at the end of the day, I'm always wondering, I love the idea of living more sustainably. Obviously, everybody around the table does. But how do we do that? If, you know, you were saying about, we have 2 years, we need to make big changes, but you can't see that happening. But what is the answer? I don't know what it is, and I don't know how we implement it.
I actually think, you know, there's a measurable indication of your lifestyle, and then what you're going to do, and you can monitor progress, and that is knowing as best you can what your carbon footprint is.
Bingo. And there's no carbon footprint tool in this country.
That's true.
We used one from the World Wildlife Society when we did it at the event. But we need one here.
Absolutely. And that will give you an indication of your personal progress. But it also, you can use it to measure against, you know, people that you deal business with in terms of the fossil fuel industry. And I think that that's something that's really tangible and also can hold carbon polluters to book in terms of their activities.
I'd also just wonder, because I rent in Dublin, you know, and so I don't own the house and the infrastructure with them in, alongside probably pretty much most of Stony Batter in Dublin 7. So I'm thinking, like, if those individuals who had to rent, because they have to live in the city to have their careers, if they could make some, half of them are in a certain bracket, they'd love to be able to live in a house that's more sustainable, but they're not, because they're old factory houses and they just don't have that at the moment. So it's about, I'm just wondering how that shift happens, and genuine question again, to enable people to feel like I can live, I can choose a house that's to rent because I can't afford to buy, that's another issue, and it be not part of the problem to the extent it is, because I know that our house is rates so low on energy. I don't even know what the terms are, but essentially I understand that when we burn heat in the winter to stay warm, it's going out the windows, you know, it's not staying within that house.
It's almost like you need to join a sustainable energy community, Avi. Which there is,
trust me, I think that's my next move. I don't know if I can live like this.
You can immediately twin with the one in North Wexford. I know, very good one.
I think rural and urban joining forces.
But it's also when I want to build a house where I'm from as well, you know, and I'm trying to figure out what's the best thing to do. Do I build a house? Do I try and buy a house that already an old house that needs renovating? You know, do I, you know, it's like all of these incredibly.
And then you start going into like the life cycle analysis of stuff, and it's just, it almost goes, it's a bit of a head melt. There's so much stuff to try to understand that you can only digest so much at a time, and you can only do your best, I think, in so much that you know and that you've educated yourself on, and you'll get to the next part and you'll get to the next part. The question can be, is it enough? And is it enough, even if we're all moving at a fairly okay kind of quick pace, is that still enough?
Well, what's enough? What's okay?
Exactly.
We don't know.
What is okay?
There's the end goal. And I do believe that the positive thing that I see in all of this is, if we all keep moving, it's going to have a ripple effect. The ripples will be very positive.
Absolutely.
And during those ripples, entrepreneurs will come about that we know nothing about right now with an idea. This is my hope. That will take, that'll be a leap. So if we're not all rowing the same way, I'm going to stick with the water analogies here, and the ripples don't keep going, then those entrepreneurs are not going to come forward. Why would they?
And the it's a 3.5% effect, isn't it? It's that the idea that if 3.5% of a population has an idea and they stick with it or they implement it, it does have a ripple effect.
Okay.
It's the Mary Reynolds uses it a lot when she talks as with the idea of rewilding. You know, if 3.5% of the population let their garden go, it becomes more of a norm and the norm, you know, so, I mean, so I'm not doing like justice.
You can accept
but
the limitations that an individual has in terms of the direct stuff that we can do. You can only do so much. You can't underestimate that ripple effect. That's the thing that's endless.
Anyway,
that's
just
the thing that keeps
always
going.
The concern is, and not to be pessimist, but like, I'm on board with the ripple effect, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's that how strong are those ripples?
Yeah,
and how
sure.
fast are they moving?
I think we're getting into something very dodgy here. Yeah. Now, I was trying to avoid finishing on Gillian's head melt. I got 3.5% of hopefulness. Then we get pessimism.
Yes, so, I'm sorry.
But I think we're going to call a halt to it. That is as much as we have time for today.
I am smiling, by the way.
So everyone is smiling. So I think there is a bit of optimism and hope around the table.
Yeah, there is.
My thanks again to my absolutely wonderful guests, Kevin O'Sullivan, Evan McCann, Gillian Gannon and Karen Finnegan. Until next time. Goodbye.
Thank you, John.
Degrees was brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. The series was recorded and produced by Headstuff Studios in Dublin. For future updates, you can subscribe to the show, and for more, visit us at seai.ie/podcast.